Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 378, titled Islamism and Geopolitics. This is being recorded on September 22nd of 2002. The pedantic format that I use in this program may be very difficult for some people to listen to. I can appreciate that, so be aware that the website of Spitfire that carries the various tapes and CDs that I've done over the years is equipped with real audio so that people can listen on the internet. Within a week, sometimes 2 weeks, of the time of recording of this program, there will be a detailed article-length written description in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. And there are links on the Spitfire website to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, that have virtually the entire For the Record series online. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL linked to both the WFMU and Spitfire websites. More about this later in the program. We're going to continue with our discussion of geopolitics and some of the broader political and economic maneuvering in and around the Middle East in relation to not only September 11th, but to also the deepening crisis vis-a-vis Iraq, Palestinians, Israel, etc. We're going to begin by referencing an article from the New York Times of April 27th of 2002, this by way of sort of flagging some of the things that I talk about. When I discuss the Nazi-Islamist connection, this might seem, again, to many people to be sort of far afield, and yet the influences that I'm talking about are right beneath the surface. New York Times, April 27th of 2002, an article by Susan Sachs titled "Anti-Semitism is Deepening Among Muslims." The article reads in part as follows. Stay in a five-star hotel anywhere from Jordan to Iran, and you can buy the infamous forgery, Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Pick up a newspaper in any part of the Arab world, and you regularly see a swastika superimposed on the Israeli flag. Such anti-Semitic imagery is now embedded in the mainstream discourse concerning Jews in much of the Islamic world, in the popular press, and in academic journals. The depictions are not limited to countries that are at war with Israel, but can be found in general interest publications in Egypt and Jordan, the two countries that have signed peace agreements with Israel, as well as in independent religious schools in Pakistan and Southeast Asia. Parenthetically, many of those financed by Saudi Wahhabism. More about that later. Arab leaders, for their part, have long rejected the accusation that their state-controlled press, universities, and television stations promulgate anti-Semitic views. Islamic history, they say, contains nothing like the anti-Semitic horrors that occurred in Christian Europe, and Islam as a religion accepts many of the revelations embodied in Judaism. The use of Nazi imagery, the newspaper caricatures of Jews with fangs and exaggerated hook noses, even the Arab textbooks with their descriptions of Jews as evil world conspirators, all of that, Arab leaders often insist, reflect a dislike for Israelis and Zionism, but not for Jews and Judaism. Well, noting there the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which, as indicated in that article, and this is something we've spoken about before, has achieved significant influence in the Middle East, this is not a document from the Middle East, but rather from Europe, and it's an anti-Semitic document that had significant influence on Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism. And that's simply by way of flagging a dynamic that I think underlies much of the maneuvering in and around September 11th, and something that also looms large in the question of the United States, Iraq, and also the deepening Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we're going to talk about geopolitics, the Middle East, and how Islamism has been utilized by National Socialism and Fascism, and what may be on the store, what may be on the horizon for the United States in that part of the world. We're going to be accessing some more of a paper that was authored by Kevin Coogan, which in turn analyzes some information and showcases information from a book by Johannes and Germania von Donani. And we talked about this in For the Record 377. We're going to talk more about it in this broadcast. But first, an article from the Wall Street Journal this past Friday, September 20th of 2002. This article highlights one of the dynamics that is at the core of some some of the discussion that we've had about September 11th and Islamism and fascism, or Islamofascism, as I call it. And this deals with another connection between some of the Saudi charities that are operating in the United States and elsewhere. And this concerns the allegations of connections between Saudi charities and al-Qaeda and the milieu of Osama bin Laden. Looming in this particular equation also is al-Taqwa, later Nada Management, an Islamo-fascist organization with a heritage going back to the Muslim Brotherhood that we've spoken about in many broadcasts. This article is by Glenn R. Simpson, again from the Wall Street Journal of 9/20/2002. It's titled, Report Links Charity to an Al-Qaeda Front. Subtitled, Bosnian Probe Suggests Actions Are Consistent with Those Who Have Financed Terror. This reads in part as follows. A Saudi-backed charity with offices in Virginia is tied to Islamic extremists and has dispersed large sums of unaccounted-for cash and trafficked in fraudulent identification documents a Bosnian government probe has found. The report summarizing the inquiry doesn't accuse the Taiban International Aid Association of financing terror, but suggests that its actions are consistent with doing so and links it to an alleged al-Qaeda front. Taiba, T-A-I-B-A-H, is run in the U.S. by a prominent Muslim activist who heads a mosque in Virginia, and by another man terror experts believe is a relative of Osama bin Laden. The other man has a residence in Northern Virginia. Skipping down. The investigators trace Taiba funds from the Al-Raji Bank in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, although the report doesn't accuse that bank of complicity. Banking magnate Suleiman Al-Raji, a bank principal, is a financial sponsor of several Islamic charities in the Washington, D.C. suburb of Herndon, Virginia, that were raided in March by U.S. terror finance investigators. By the way, that is the Operation Green Quest raid that we've spoken about in numerous broadcasts. And in fact, Talat Otman, a director of George Bush's Harkin Energy, who gave Islamic benediction, an un-Islamic benediction, at the Republican Convention in the year 2000, interceded on behalf of many of these people and institutions whose assets were seized, including a number of people, some of whom are discussed later in this article, with links to the al-Taqwa milieu. Continuing. A federal suit in Washington, D.C. by victims of the September 11th attacks accuses Mr. Raji of helping fund al-Qaeda, but the U.S. hasn't accused him of that, and he adamantly denies it. A lawyer for the Raji family had no immediate comment. Skipping down. Abdullah bin Laden, who is listed as a Taiba officer in Virginia, owns residential property in Falls Church, where the charity maintains a postal box. He also used to run the U.S. office of the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, a Saudi government-backed group. Skipping down. Another Taiba officer in the U.S. is Abdulrahman Alamoudi, a prominent Muslim and an avowed supporter of anti-Israeli terror groups. An official at the American Muslim Foundation, which he heads, said he was unavailable. A third Taiba officer in Virginia, Samir Salah, also was an officer of Safa Trust, one of the Herndon entities raided in March. A message left for Mr. Salah at Daral Hijra Mosque in Falls Church, where he is president, wasn't immediately returned. The U.S. lists Mr. Salah as an officer of the Bahamas branch of the bank al-Taqwa, which the Treasury Department alleges is a money manager for terrorist groups. And note again, al-Taqwa, Samir Salah, somebody we spoke about in For the Record 356 and 357. And again, Talat Otman, a longtime associate of both George's Bush, interceded on behalf of these elements with the Treasury Department on April 4th of 2002, as we looked at in For the Record 356 and in 376. What we're going to do next is to take a look at some more of this paper that was authored by Kevin Coogan. The title of the paper is Report on Islamists, the Far Right, and al-Taqwa. And this article talks, this paper talks at considerable length about al-Taqwa, also the focal point of an article by Kevin Coogan called The Mysterious Ahmed Huber, Friend to Hitler, Allah, and Bin Laden, originally published in Hit List magazine and discussed at great length and For the Record 354, that is now on the web. In this paper, Kevin Coogan devotes much of the text to highlighting some key aspects of the book Schmutzige Geschäfte und Heiliger Krieg, Al-Qaeda in Europe, that's Dirty Business and Holy War, Al-Qaeda in Europe, published by Pendo Verlag from Zurich of 2002, co-authored by Johannes and Germana von Donani. We dealt with this paper at considerable length last week, and I apologize, by the way, on September 22nd of 2002, I am just completing the written description that will be up within a couple of days. We're going to begin the concluding portion of Kevin's paper by discussing some meetings between one of Al-Taqwa, later NADA Management's founders, Ahmed Huber, and other leaders of the European far right. This particular meeting took place at Mont Pèlerin in Switzerland, and the next to last section of Kevin's paper is titled Huber and the Mount Pelerin Meeting, or Mount Pèlerin Meeting. It reads, "Perhaps the most recent remarkable story concerning Huber comes from a brief item in the Swiss tabloid Blick that in an April 26, 2002 article by Alexander Sauter, S-A-U-T-T-E-R, that Huber was involved in a meeting of far-right leaders from Europe. A photo showing Huber with Jean-Marie Le Pen accompanies the article. The Blick story available on the web is as follows. Mont Pèlerin, V.D., Christian Cambuzat, the promoter Scharfmacher of the right extremist Jean-Marie Le Pen. The guru assembles together some of the top leaders of the European right. On the idyllic Mont Pèlerin, they debate their crude ideas. At his secret visit to a spa in Switzerland, Le Pen hardly remained alone. Rightist leaders from all over Europe traveled to meet the extremist presidential candidate who was hosted by Cambuzat. Franz Schoenhuber, founder of the Republican Party in Germany and a former member of the SS, talked with Le Pen, who, together with Schoenhuber, constitutes the Front National faction in the European Parliament. Gianfranco Fini, 50, Italian post-fascist, Mussolini admirer, and founder of the Alleanza Nazionale. He was also at the meeting with Le Pen and Schoenhuber." And by the way, there are many links between Gianfranco Fini, part of the coalition government of Silvio Berlusconi, an original member of the P2 Lodge in Italy, and the milieu of Al-Taqwa/NADA management. We looked at some of those last week and in other discussions of Al-Taqwa. More from Kevin's paper. Ahmed Huber, 74. "The Swiss is on the Bush administration blacklist." Quote, "I met Le Pen at Mont Pèlerin as he went to Christian Cambuzat's spa," Huber told Bleak yesterday. "At the extremist rendezvous, an American far-right politician was also supposed to have taken part." And Kevin notes parenthetically that that American is not further identified. Christian Cambuzat, C-A-M-B-U-Z-A-T, said that Le Pen, after the elections, had again become the sharpest weapon of the Front National because Le Pen changed his image from a venomous old man to a, quote, "kindly U.S. TV evangelist," unquote. Proudly, Cambuzat brags, quote, "with me, Le Pen can relax well," unquote, and openly link up with new contacts. And Kevin adds parenthetically, although the Bleak story does not give details, Cambuzat runs a spa for the very rich, the Lémanique de Revitalisation, inside a hotel on the famous Mont Pèlerin. And the conclusion of Kevin's article here is, in many ways, the jumping-off point to the rest of the discussion. And this concerns the relationship between far-rightists and outright fascists and some of their Islamist colleagues. And this, in turn, reflects the dynamic that I've spoken about in the past, the geopolitical struggle for control of the Earth Island, that long stretch of land running from the Straits of Gibraltar in Europe all the way across Europe, most of the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, India, Pakistan, and China. Not only comprises most of the world's landmass, but also most of the world's proven petroleum reserves. In the middle of it is a large stretch of a largely Muslim population, and the German geopoliticians saw the control of that as a key to controlling the world, and with the position of petroleum in the industrial world having, if anything, increased in the years since the early 1920s, the strategic importance of that part of the world is enormous, and the economic control and a resulting political influence stemming from the economic control in that part of the world will in many ways hold the key to the future. And one of the things Kevin Coogan ruminates about in this article concerns the possible manipulation of Muslim public opinion by the fascist Islamist axis in order to shift the enormous petroleum wealth from dollar denomination to euro denomination, with a resulting exponential increase in economic and political power by European banks associated with far-right and fascist elites. Kevin titles the last part of this paper, Conclusion, the Nazi-Islamist Connection. It reads, The overwhelming thrust of this report has been to give the reader a great deal of empirical information that he or she may not have easy access to in order that they may evaluate the claims for themselves. I have avoided drawing any conclusions because I do not feel qualified to draw conclusions about the Islamist financial machinations this report discusses. However, I find it impossible not to put out a call for further research involving the overlap between Nazi and Islamist networks that seems to have been in continual contact from the 1930s until today. In the case of Janu, Huber, and Ramadan, that's a reference to Saeed Ramadan, the son-in-law of Muslim Brotherhood founder Hassan al-Banna, and himself, that is to say Saeed Ramadan, a key operative of the Muslim Brotherhood, also an associate of François Janu. Beginning the sentence again, in the case of Janu, Huber, and Ramadan, this is becoming more and more impossible to avoid. My own belief is that it is less the apparently fantastic and James Bond-like quality of this analysis that is most difficult to understand. The real difficulty is the utter ignorance of most Westerners, Americans in particular, about the very existence of such people as François Janu. Thus, when Ernest Bacchus, one of Europe's leading experts in money laundering, told the Luxembourg-based economic journal Plus Minus last year that he believed the financial source of funds for the September 11th terrorists would ultimately be traced back to Swiss accounts established by Janu, few Americans had any idea what Bacchus could possibly be talking about. For this same reason, there has been virtually no independent investigation into Cicos Baudin-Dunant's relationship to Janu, or, for that matter, the role that the Syrian-born Mohammed Mardam Bey, believed to be related to a former Syrian foreign minister, has played both as a member of Magnan Dunant and Associates, as well as Bey's possible links with Janu. And what does it mean when we are told that Youssef Nada, for example, is believed by Egyptian authorities to have worked for German intelligence in World War II? Parenthetically, of course, Youssef Nada, the founder of Al-Taqwa, later Nada Management. François Janu is a key Nazi operative in the pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II periods, an operative on behalf of the Odessa, closely identified with the fascist third position and the heir to the literary works of Joseph Goebbels, Martin Bormann, and Adolf Hitler. We've spoken about Janu in numerous broadcasts, including many of them connected to September 11th. For the record, 343, for the record, 354, 352, 356, and 357 among those broadcasts. More about the conclusion of Kevin's paper, and here I'm going to include some of Kevin's ruminations about some of the macroeconomics. It is not at all impossible that networks first developed in the 1930s and who saw their economic power fantastically multiplied in the wake of the enormous hike in oil prices in 1973, are now engaged in trying to enact a major financial shift away from the dollar and Anglo-American financial networks, and to shift the vast wealth of the Muslim oil states into a new, euro-based financial network that would vastly increase the power of those banks and financial interests in Europe associated with elements of far-right elites that survived World War II relatively intact. If this were at all the case, it would not be a new development. The very same attempt to develop an independent Saudi-German hookup to subvert the U.S. and British domination of the Saudi oil markets was actually attempted in the mid-1950s. At that time, the Saudi royal family, using the advice of the famous German banker Hjalmar Schacht, also parenthetically I would add, a finance minister of the Third Reich, attempted to employ Aristotle Onassis to transport Saudi oil on new oil tankers that would be constructed in the shipyards of Germany. This attempt to break the Western oil control over Saudi Arabia was finally blocked by the United States, a story well documented in Jim Hogan's book Spooks. The documentation regarding this complex question is there for anyone who wants to examine it. Of course, I am not attempting to suggest a simple monocausal explanation for the current crisis. What I am suggesting is that sooner or later, these connections between the far right and groups like the Muslim Brotherhood that began in the 1930s and continue today will have to become the subject of serious and sober research in order to help us shed new light on the extraordinary circumstances we are living under today. And again, that authored by Kevin Coogan on September 11th of 2002. Now, we're going to take a look at the Jeddah Agreement, which is the Yalmar Schacht brokered agreement, later interdicted by elements of CIA, that Kevin alluded to. And we're also going to listen to some ruminations by Omar Amin von Leers, nay, Johann von Leers, Joseph Goebbels' propaganda minister in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda, and later a key associate of not only Nasser, but also of the Grand Mufti, and more importantly for our purposes, one of his protégés, in effect, the aforementioned Ahmed Huber. Now, note again the concept of geopolitics. Note the view here that Islam represents the hope for national socialism against the West. And we're also going to read here about some of the very significant, though largely unrecognized, German/Middle Eastern connections, including the Jeddah Agreement that was alluded to by Kevin in the last part of his discussion. Turning to Kevin's landmark opus, Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yaki and the Post-War Fascist International, published in soft cover by Otano Media, copyright 1999, and by the way, edited by Dave Mandel, an on-air personality at sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. Kevin writes in Dreamer of the Day, the Nazi-Nasser axis, of course, that is a reference to former Egyptian President Nasser. The Nazi-Nasser axis, a post-war continuation of Karl Haushofer's policy of alliance with the colored world, was evident in the strange mix of fascist, geopolitical, and anti-imperialist rhetoric that flowed from von Leers' pen. In an August 8, 1958 letter to H. Keith Thompson, Leers explained, one thing is clear. More and more German patriots join the great Arab revolution against beastly imperialism. In Algeria, half a company of German soldiers, dragging with them two French officers and two non-commissioned officers, have cut their throats in view of the Algerian revolutionaries and have gone on the side of the Algerians and have embraced Islam. That is good. To hell with Christianity, for in Christianity's name, Germany has been sold to our oppressors. Our place as an oppressed nation under the execrable Western imperialist Bonn government must be on the side of the Arab nationalist revolt against the West. Let Adenauer be furious that honest German patriots are not extradited to him or to his British or American bosses by those freedom-loving Arab countries. May the British swine call us meddlers. In a short time, British meddling in the Middle East will be over, as it has finished in Iraq, where the infidel servants of British imperialism are all killed. Ihamud al-Allah. The backing given by the USA to the Jewish tyrants in Germany will make the German nation revolt. Indeed, for our nation, there is only one hope, to get rid of Western imperialism by joining the Arab-led anti-imperialist group. Skipping down in Kevin's text. Another key figure involved in German intrigue in the Middle East was Yalmar Schacht. He first came to Egypt as General Naguib's guest of honor after the coup against King Farouk. Schacht's most daring Middle East power play was the Jeddah Agreement between German industry and Saudi Arabia in January of 1954. Under the terms of the deal, Saudi Arabia agreed to establish a fleet of supertankers to be built in German shipyards that would carry Saudi oil around the world. Aristotle Onassis was chosen to manage the shipping side of the operation, and besides making the Ruhr industrialists fantastically wealthy, Jeddah threatened to break the Seven Sisters Oil Company's hegemony over the distribution of Middle East oil. The Jeddah Agreement was ultimately blocked by the Western oil cartel with help from the CIA. Yet Alan Dulles' CIA was surprisingly hesitant to confront Schacht. Robert Mayhew, one of the coordinators of the American attack on Jeddah, said of the CIA, quote, you can't imagine how hard it was to convince them that the national interest was at stake, unquote. And a couple of questions I have. I would note that Alan Dulles, of course, was present along with British spy and Nazi double agent Jack Philby, as well as King Ibn Saud himself, with some interesting connections to the Third Reich at the very birth of Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Bin Laden Group, the Bin Laden Construction Company, and the foundation of the Bin Laden Economic Empire was founded in 1931, actually predating Saudi Arabia per se by a year. And the counsel for Saudi Bin Laden Group is Sullivan & Cromwell, the old Dulles law firm. And I wonder, and this is an interrogatory note, to what extent the Saudi Bin Laden Group may have been involved in some of the post-war Nazi underground money-go-round, so to speak. More about some of the German/Nazi links to the Saudi establishment, skipping down in Kevin's text. Another prominent member of the German China Society was Werner Otto von Hentig, a former head of the Arab division of von Ribbentrop's Foreign Office and a close friend of Nazi agent Fritz Graube. King Ibn Saud made Hentig Saudi Arabia's chief European advisor in 1955. While serving as German ambassador to Indonesia, Hentig accompanied the Saudi delegation to the April 1955 Afro-Asian Conference held in Bandung, Indonesia, as a special counselor. He also helped broker Soviet-Arab relations in the Mideast. By the way, in a number of our discussions with Kevin Coogan about the Bandung Conference, we've talked about the profound role in that conference that was played by Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Now, reviewing an item very quickly, also from Dreamer of the Day, and this concerning the relationship between Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, again a linchpin of German finance, former finance minister of the Third Reich, and the architect of the abortive Jeddah Agreement. Hjalmar Schacht was very close to, among others, the aforementioned François Genoux. Talking about the connections here between the Grand Mufti and von Leers and Genoux, Kevin Coogan writes in Dreamer of the Day, in 1955, with the Grand Mufti's friend Johann von Leers helping to run Egypt's propaganda ministry and its all-important Institute for the Study of Zionism, Genoux began to see Egypt as a base for the anti-French FLN independence movement in Algeria. He worked in Tangier with an ex-SS officer named Hans Reichenberg to create the Arabo-Africa Import-Export Company, which supplied the FLN with weapons. Arabo-Africa was actually a cover enterprise established by Werner Naumann's network and included Genoux's friend, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht. We've spoken about the Naumann network in the past. That was part of the post-war SS political underground with strong connections not only to the post-war SS but also to elements of Western intelligence. So again, some of the macroeconomic and macro-political implications of some of the maneuvering going on in the Middle East are worth considering, and certainly no country is going to overwhelm the United States on the battlefield, but if public opinion in the Middle East were to become sufficiently alienated, it could signify a tremendous shift in the denomination of oil from dollars to euros, and that in turn would be a very significant effect indeed. Spitfire's website, www.spitfirelist.com, is equipped with real audio, and within a week or so of the recording of this program on 9/22/2002, there will be a detailed article-length annotated description of For the Record 378 on the Spitfire website. And again, sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older shows at a longer URL for download only, linked to both the WFMU website and the Spitfire website. This concludes For the Record 378, Islamism and Geopolitics, being recorded on September 22, 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.